Okay, what I want to do is to remind you of where we left off yesterday. And the last point, I left you with a definition of what it is to be human for John of the Cross. What it is to be human is to be defined as a possibility for something beyond myself. I'm defined through my capacity to have a relationship with, to know, and to love God. Put it quite simply. And to arrive at that, I tried to take you into a 16th century way of thinking, which was a way of thinking which was always open to God, but is marked in a wonderful way in that it is grounded in our experience of ourselves. It's grounded in human experience. Can you hear with all these fans going? Can you hear down the back? Because I don't have a strong voice. So those of you who can't hear, you have to come up the front. And it's grounded in, not simply, we might turn them down a bit, turn them down to about the lowest or the second lowest. Yeah, otherwise I'll blow away, I'll fly away, in fact. Just enough to circulate the air, good. So it's grounded in a sense of my experience is valid, and my experience speaks something to me, especially when my experience is also within the context of a correct relationship with God. When that's in place, I can look at my experience and begin to understand myself from that. And we noted that one of the primal experiences is I have likes and dislikes. I have desires, in other words, which we then try to look at from three different perspectives. We can look at the effect of the desire on me. By that I meant how I respond to the desire. When I live out a desire, sometimes they make me a better person, sometimes they make me a worse person, sometimes they're indifferent. Okay? We also noted that there are degrees of desire. Some desires are obviously of a higher order than other desires. Okay, and then we also noted that we can have different intensities of desire. And then we all brought all of that into the context of belief in God and openness to God, which in terms of desire is grounded in the intensity. We have a desire for the infinite. We have a desire to love more than we love now and to be loved more than we are loved now. In other words, those desires are in some way unlimited, at least in our experience of them. And if we accept something of the experience to be true, it automatically opens us towards the infinite in some manner or form. This is 16th century thinking, especially John is very strong on this. And then that led us to that sense of, well, then it's about God somehow. So the human person defined and experienced this way is something which looks towards a reality beyond itself, towards a reality greater than itself. And not only that it looks beyond itself, but that reality which we call God, in fact, is what defines who I am. And so, quite apart from lots of the present-day thinking, I can be judged. And it's not an artificially imposed judgment. It's something which is about myself. If I am made for something and all of my desires and everything about me is directed towards something else, then that something else in some way is not only what I want, but it defines me. And therefore my humanness, my person, what I am, can be judged by that thing which is beyond myself. It's a very powerful way of thinking, in fact. And it's simply grounded in who we are. So that's where we left off last night. Do you have any thoughts or questions before we move on? Because I'm very well aware that I generally race through things and you all come in thinking that was very nice, but probably all forgot what I said. Any thoughts or questions? Okay, don't think too hard, we'll move on. What I want to do today now is to look at desires a bit more and see what they're about and what's happening there. and then introduce to you sometime towards the end of this session John's understanding of the soul. And then this evening we will look and see how all of these things work and how they fit together in the human person, which is very interesting, because whatever I do or don't do, in fact, impacts upon me. And you need to know how it does, because once you can see how your life impacts upon you as a person from John's perspective, you can begin to see what to do to correct and to bring healing to yourself. You can also look to see the way God works in it and the place that God plays within it. That's what we'll hope to be by this evening. And if not, we'll be there by tomorrow. That means what I want to do tomorrow won't be done, but we'll see how we go. Okay, remember also, if you can remember, that I also began last night by quoting part of John of the Cross in his way of looking at a human being. And he said that the greatest thing, of course, is our call to love. To love the Lord your God with all of your heart, soul, mind and strength. The question that we need to ask John in terms of that is, well then, what are we supposed to do about that? We're told to love the Lord your God with all of your heart, soul, mind and strength. And so what do we do now? And I took that passage from the second book of the Dark Knight, chapter 11. We could also have gone to the third book of the Ascent of Mount Carmel, about chapter 16, but I picked that one for some reason, so we'll continue with that. Where John says of that, that you shall love the Lord your God with all of your heart, soul, mind and strength. But how do I do that? And he says in paragraph 3 of chapter 11 of the second book of the Dark Knight, in order to receive the strength of this union, don't worry about what that means, but in order, how do I respond to this commandment to love the Lord your God with all of your heart, soul, mind and strength? The answer that he gives, he begins as he normally does by quoting from Scripture. And this is from Psalm 58. I will keep my strength for you. And he says, that is, all the ability of the appetites, which we will see as the desires, and the strength of the faculties, which we will name later on this morning, are to be directed towards God. That's how it's going to come about. He's not saying anything that you wouldn't have worked out for yourself. What does it mean to love the Lord your God with all of your heart, soul, mind and strength, except to look and see what aspects there are within myself? And when I can have the nuanced way of understanding myself, I can see the different parts of myself which must now be directed towards God with all of my heart, soul, mind and strength. Because otherwise, it's a very bland statement. You hear it every year at Mass, don't you? Love the Lord your God with all of your heart, soul, mind and strength. You know, that's nice. But you don't know what to do, do you? You leave Mass thinking that was very nice, and Father said some rather nice things about it. But in fact, Father probably didn't say anything which could help you in a practical way. Because it was more than likely something which was simply just, yes, it was a platitude. Now, John doesn't want to give us a platitude. He's going to say, let's have a look and see what has to be done in order to love the Lord your God with all of your heart, soul, mind and strength. Okay? So that's where we're going this morning. Last night, I spoke to you about desires. Now, I want to have you stop and think, how do you identify a desire? How do you know you've got a desire? Because there's something, okay? You can't speak about a desire unless there's an object that you're either wanting or running away from. So you desire not this, or you desire this. And if this wasn't there, you probably wouldn't experience a desire, would you? It might be something in your imagination, that's fine, and we'll see how that works probably tonight. Because that's something which is already there. That's how memory and intellect start to impact. But if you didn't have a memory, you would only have a desire because there was something there. Okay? It's an interesting thing. John is a very powerful thinker, and we will look at something about memory this evening. But generally, there has to be something there that you desire, that you want or don't want. Okay? So the first thing that I have to do for John when I want to try to understand what's happening is I have to move away from the desire first of all. Because otherwise, every time I look at desire, really it's tangled up with the thing, isn't it? And that's a confusion in John's way of thinking, because I'm never really looking at what a desire is, isn't it? Because I say there's something about desires which helps me understand who I am and is defining, but when it's caught up with the thing, I can't see what's happening. I'll give you a good example of that. You're afraid of something, and you might have got to the point now that you are neurotic about it. That desire has now so caught up with fear that you can't begin to look and see what's happening, because your whole focus is the thing that you're afraid of. Okay? And if someone wants to say, well, this is what you need to do when you've got these fears and desires, they'll have to start to talk to you about fears and desires without the thing that you're afraid of. Because whenever the thing is that you're afraid of is there, you go ballistic. You can't stop and do anything. You're not free anymore. Okay? See, when there's a desire and there's the object there, it has implications for your own ability. We'll look at this tonight, to think, to be free and all that kind of thing. So the first thing we need to do when we start to look at John's understanding of the human person is move away from the desire, to see what's desire about, what's underpinning desire. Because when you think about desire, you get caught up with the thing. Okay? Is that true for some of you? It's a peculiar thing. So we need to take another step, because John's main thinking is at what's underpinning the desire. And, well, you've got desires about you. Well, I'm Chinese, I can't help but talk about these things. We all want to eat something. The Chinese will always give examples from food. We are a very strange people. It's very odd. Actually, a few of us were invited to someone's house the other night, Father Peter, Father Tig, and myself. And these people were Singaporean, Chinese, and Indians. The husband is an Indian Singaporean, and the wife's a Chinese Singaporean. And Father Peter goes in, and as we're sitting, he said, problem with Father Greg's, he's fanatical about food. And literally, he realized these two are more fanatical than I am. It's a cultural thing. And I could see Peter sitting there thinking, what's happening here? And they just wouldn't stop talking about food. We were eating and they were talking about what they ate last week and what they're going to eat tomorrow. And it just went, and Peter just sat there thinking, and I turned to him and I said, I'm not that bad after all, am I? This is culture. This is a different people have different kinds of things. So let's take the example about the desire for food. If you ate something which gave you food poisoning, you will probably be irrational about it for the rest of your life. You'd be too afraid to eat it again. And everyone else is saying, this is beautiful, try it. No, I can't, just thinking about it makes me sick. Okay? Or you could find a position where there's something that you like and you spend all your time trying to find that to eat. There's something untoward happening here. There's a desire there, yes. But really, what's behind the desire? What is behind the desire? What grounds the desire for food, which can make you repulse from a food or simply hanker after another food? What's behind it? Because there you've got two different desires. What's the underlying commonality? No. You have an appetite for food. There are different kinds of desires, which you might speak of as wanting or not wanting. But you can want or not want something in the area of food because we have a fundamental appetite for food. Okay? Sorry?
Is
For survival, yes. But it's more simply than for survival. There's also a human component to it as well. We have an appetite for food because we need to eat in order to survive. But we also have an appetite which has got to do with culture, quality of life, and that kind of thing as well. Okay. Yes, that's true, which we will look at hopefully a little this evening. We've got a lot to do this evening, haven't we? This evening is kind of like a little receptacle that I'm throwing everything into. But behind a desire, then, we speak about as wants and not wanting. John says, you can only desire something because you have an appetite for it. You can't desire something if you haven't got the capacity to desire it in the first place. Okay? Let's imagine that there is another sense that this other animal has got. Okay, that will impact upon, let's not say an animal, let's say that there is another kind of person other than a human being, and they've got everything that we've got, but they've got this other sense. Let's call it the ability to, I don't know, to possum, whatever that means. Okay? If they have that ability, they've got an appetite for it, which means they can therefore have desires in relation to that. But I don't have that ability. Therefore, I don't have the appetite, therefore I can't desire. Now, we're just going backwards in that. We can identify what our appetites are because we have desires. But we can only desire something because we've got the capacity for it. Okay? Take someone who was born blind. I don't know what it's like, but can they desire to see things? Could they? They should have the capacity to see, but they don't. And given that they've never had it, are they able to say, I wish I could see something? What does it mean for someone like that to say, I wish I could see? Because a desire somehow needs to be grounded in something. You look very perplexed. But what do they mean when they say that?
Because of the desire.
Because they have been told by others what it means to see. And therefore they can at least imagine what it must be like. And therefore desire it.
Can you imagine what it's like to see if you have never seen anything? I don't know. I'm only asking you a question. I've got no idea. Well, I could say to you, you see that table, you can see it, you can touch it, you can hear it. Shane told me not to do that because it upsets the microphone. You can smell it and you can also possum it. And possuming it is like this. It doesn't matter what you imagine. Do you know what I'm talking about?
You would wonder about
that. I have no answers. I'm just throwing these at you to make you start thinking differently. Because once you start thinking differently, you'll start to get into what I'm about to say next. Okay.
He was born blind.
I don't know.
It's like us desiring to see God. You know, we have not seen God, but we have this faith that one day we'll be with him.
But that's because you have a capacity for God and an appetite for God, John would say. But if you don't have a capacity for, you won't have an appetite for. And if you don't have an appetite for, you won't really have a desire for either. Because they're linked in that sense.
Can I ask a question? Because I'm not sure I'm getting this totally. I don't have a capacity to be in two places at once, yet I have the constant desire for that. I mean, I think I'm missing something. I think I'm missing something here.
Yes, but that's...
I don't have the capacity to read somebody else's.
That's different, because what you've got is, in fact, you're working you're working with what you already know. This is just a difference of degree. To be in two places at once would have to be like being here and there, because you've been here and you've been there. It would be lovely, but you could be in three places at once or four places at once, because this is just an extension of being at one place at once. So it's an imaginative extension of I'm here, but I could be here and there, and I could be here and there and there and there and there and there. And you could why be in two places at once? Why not be in 752 places at once? Which would be stupid, because you'd be in 753 places at once. Then you hand it over to Carl, because we're moving into mathematics. So that's just. Okay, we won't go any further on this, because this is not what I'm just tossing this to you to suddenly make you think, I've never thought like this before, because what John is going to give us an understanding of is eminently sensible, but you probably never thought that way before. That's the only thing. Now, I'm going to do what I'm not meant to do. I'm going to put something on the board and hope that that picks me up. Okay. What we're going to do now, we're beginning to try to understand what the soul is for John of the Cross. Okay? And there are a number of ways we can look at the soul. But just like we said last night, what is this? What's that thing at the back there on the wall? You all tell me it's a clock. And Sister Jonah says, no, it's not. It's because there's a nail on the wall, and I want to cover that nail. It looks unsightly, a nail on the wall. Most of you would say, but that's what the nail's there for you to put the clock on. But maybe the nail was there before the clock, which it probably had to be. So the clock's there to cover the nail. But you look at it, and you tell me, no, that's a clock. Because you would generally move automatically to the highest thing that this thing can do. Okay, that's the way we normally think. Okay, what's that? That's something that if you've got nowhere to sleep tonight, you can sleep in there. But you know, someone else will say to me, "So no, that's a car. You can. That's what picked me up at the station." Oh no, there's a lot of room in there. I say that's where you can sleep. What you do in trying to work out what it is in this 16th century way, which is late medieval thought, what is it? What does it do? Okay, that's because things are there for a purpose. What's its purpose? Okay, now if I just said to you, there's a way of thinking which is teleological, and we ask you what the purpose is, you think, well, that's what we naturally do. You walk and you see all these things on, and you say they're chairs because that's what they're for. Someone else could say, oh, they're just there to make the place look like a conference room. It depends what you want to say. But we tend to say, what's it for? And we pick the highest possibility, don't we? We don't pick the lowest possibility. They're all there for the cats to come and jump on, which the cat does when it comes into the room. But we say they're there for people to sit on. So when John looks at the soul, he says, one of the ways of looking at it is to say, what's it for? Looks at the human person, what's it for? How do I work out what it's for? What does it do? Okay, what can it do? Rather than what does it do, what can it do? Because that covers the blind person. Human beings can see. The fact that you can't see doesn't stop you from being a human being. You don't have to be able to see to be human, but it's what you can do. What can a human being do? Okay? That's the way John would ask of the soul. What is a human being? What is the human soul? Who is Twi? Well, rather than who is, what is he? What can he do? Okay, it doesn't mean you can do it very well. Like, human beings can swim, I can't. That doesn't make me not a human being, but if I'd been taught earlier on, I would have been able to learn. But rather than to be human is to be able to swim, to be human is to have mechanical ability. Okay, and some have got different kinds of mechanical ability. I happen to have very poor mechanical ability. That's probably why I became a Carmelite. So when we look at the soul, there are what we would simply say its abilities or its capacities. Okay? The word that John uses from this way of thinking is it has certain powers. Now, that's another way of putting it, is to say I have the capacity to see, I have the power of sight. I am able to be mobile, I have the power of mobility. I'm able to speak, I have the power of speech. Okay? So he identifies it rather than as a capacity in this sense, as a, in the positive sense. But behind the power, of course, is a capacity. And a power. Okay. How do these powers express themselves? How do they express themselves? You could say desires, but John wants to put something in between the desire and the power. And he calls that an appetite. Why does he use the word appetite, first of all? Because it simply is, because I have the power to see, I have the desire to see, I have the appetite to see. Whereas when I speak about the desire to see, that generally is a desire to see this or to see that, isn't it? When I speak about desires generally, that's how I would begin to speak about it. So that's what I want to do for the moment, is to draw back from the desire by coming this way. You have an appetite. Okay. And I experience the appetite because I desire. That in fact is the experience of the appetite, isn't it? You've always got the appetite and the power to see, but you don't always want to see. Okay? You're not always somehow experiencing your power to see. You're not always experiencing your appetite to see. When you try to go to sleep, you're trying to turn it off. Okay? You turn the lights out. Okay? You've always got the power to eat. You've always got an appetite, but you're not always hungry. Okay? Not always hungry. You've got the power, if you want to put it, to go to sleep. Okay? Which means you've always got, there's that appetite there, but you're not always sleepy. Okay? Now, the reason that I want to make that distinction is because for the first moment, I now want to turn to look at appetites for St. John of the Cross. Because these are, for him, the important things to begin to look at in order to understand the human person and how the person works. Because we need to look at it. I suppose this is a way of looking at it theoretically, as opposed to, I want this now. Okay, because if we're only talking at that level, we're always talking about what's impinging upon me now. John makes two little distinctions in appetites. First of all, there are voluntary and involuntary appetites. It's a lovely distinction because it'll help you understand why we have to move away from desires. There are some appetites which involve free will. Okay? Because that's a power working and I make a choice. But there are others where there is no free will. You might call it instinct if you like. Okay, so we have a... a power which is within myself, which is I have the capacity to preserve my life. Okay? It's one of the most primordial capacities we have. We have all these things within us by which we simply preserve our lives. We go on living. That's the power. And therefore there's the appetite there. So I come along to Marissa with a flaming brand and I go forward to her like that. What does she do? She jumps away. Was that voluntary? No, she just jumped away. But if she didn't have the power and the appetite for that, she would sit there and say, "Whoa, no." And she jumps away. She doesn't sit there and say, what am I going to do? Will I jump away or not? In fact, a whole part of life goes on because certain of the appetites are involuntary. They just happen. Okay. We're not interested in them. We're interested in the voluntary ones. But once I make that distinction, the next part will become clearer. Okay, because in the voluntary appetites is where I have freedom. And when I look at the voluntary appetites, those appetites, and let's run through many of the appetites we've got. Just go through the seven deadly sins. Okay. Funny how we understand appetites better when we look at sins. But you also run through virtues as well, because the other side of a vice is always a virtue. Okay. In fact, for Aristotle, every virtue has two vices, one on either side. One is excess, one is deficiency. Okay? You have an appetite for knowledge. You can have that can be exercised in excess, that's curiosity, or wanting knowledge to such an extent that it puts the rest of your life out of balance, or I simply don't want to learn anything. I don't want to know anything. Okay? Because for every virtue, for Aristotle, and this would also be for John of the Cross, that there are basically two vices. We go too far in either too much or too little. Okay, same kind of thing with eating. There's gluttony and there's anorexia, isn't there? Same thing. Okay, same kind of thing with pride. There is authentic personal integrity, and there is pride, I'm the best, or I'm just useless. There's excessive self-love or lack of self-love. Whereas what is the power and the possibility through that power? Authentic self-love. And then how it runs out is how the appetite works for John of the Cross. Okay.